on the, when we do these chanting retreats, and we do 1 or 2 days, 64 rounds, it basically means it takes you like 8 or 10 hours. And you're not talking, you're taking a vow of silence. So the next day, you definitely, you're chanting even when you're not. It's just going on. And I'll tell you a nice story. It said in all spiritual books, it said that a spiritual person is always engaged. Mind, body, words, is always engaged in spiritual activity. And they're never engaged in material activity. So one man was in the room with my spiritual master, and my spiritual master was engaged in all kinds of what appeared to this man to be not spiritual activity or organizational activity. You want to get it? Well, there's a chair over there. So I think the camera has to stay there. No? Is the camera?
When it's used.
Yeah. You'd rather sit in the middle.
I'm okay here, thanks. Okay.
So this man was observing in the room. My spiritual master was organizing things within his organization. And this man was observing, and he was thinking, you know, I've read that spiritual people, they just engage in spiritual discussion and talk. So later he asked him, he said, but I thought the spiritual person is always chanting or speaking. And he said, come. He said, put your ear on my, I don't know where it was, body, shoulder, heart. And he put his ear and he could hear Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, going on. So when you get to a certain level, it goes on constantly. Now, does anyone else like to share anything? Yes.
Yeah, you know, I'm used to meditating by myself, as you explained yesterday, as japa. And when we were chanting in the group, I was having a really tough time. And finally, I switched myself to bhajan mode, which is when we share.
Uh-huh.
And I stopped my beads, and then I could just meditate. Otherwise, I was having I don't know if people who chant regularly had that experience.
I'm
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sometimes, yeah. So that means you want to chant in a situation which is conducive, most conducive, whatever it is. Some people like chanting with other people, it helps them. Some people get distracted.
The chanting with other people in that syncopated way where each word has to be said at the same time as everybody else's. That's
and then keeping track on the beats.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's normally we don't chant that way, but When you're chanting, the best situation to chant in is where you're least distracted. So if you want to take this chanting with you, you can do it in your home, ideally in the morning, is the best time. The more there's distraction around you, the more difficult it's going to be. So maybe this was a kind of distraction for Pradyumna. In this sense.
Well, no, I mean, once I switched to bhajan, which was, you know, okay, I want to focus on being with the group rather than, you know, and then I was fine. But it was just interesting.
Actually,
a mental switch.
There's two things. We talked yesterday about kirtan, and kirtan means when you're chanting together, singing together. And that's a spiritual social activity. But japa is private. And a lot of people ask, well, why do you chant on beads? Because the tradition is that you commit to a certain number. Not a certain time, but a certain number. And just as in any relationship, there's always a commitment that makes a relationship good. Commit if you're married, or we commit to meeting one another at a certain time. So the counting on the beads is a commitment that I will be there. With this chanting, I'll be there for God every day for 1 round, 2 rounds, 4 rounds. That's the idea. So the whole tradition has always been counting. And if they didn't have beads, they'd count on their hands. But they'd always keep this number because that was their commitment to the relationship. So that's why beads are used. And sacred beads are also used, sacred plants called tulsi. And when you touch the bead, it's purifying. So you're not only engaging your speaking and hearing, you're engaging touching. So being in an environment which for you is sacred is very, very good. So a lot of people do that in their homes. They create some place, some pictures, altar, burn incense, create the right environment, and then chant. The environment is very powerful. And the more you're in an environment where you can be distracted, the more difficulty you'll have when you're chanting. This comes from many years of experience. And when you're in a distracted environment, it's practically impossible to be completely focused. So if you're ever chanting, or if you want to chant when you're out and about, it's always good to find some place that's less, where there's less going on. Because as you can see, chanting requires some kind of a fairly peaceful environment, because the mind tends to be very active, as you've noticed, right? And people who are involved in a lot of activities with a lot going on will tell us again and again, I can't chant, my mind's too disturbed, I can't hear. So that's why we recommend the morning, because you tend to be more peaceful in the morning. So if you can, that's ideal. And then, but in general, just any environment which is not distracting. And you'll find, if you just chant a little properly, you'll find that to be more effective than chanting a lot improperly. So it's not just quantity, but quality is more important. And you can really be focused on the sound, hearing, feeling. And we'll talk more about that later. Does anyone have anything else they wanted to share?
I found myself less distracted now than I did.
Last night, yeah. The morning is... Yeah, of course, we had spiritual discussions last night. That helps. If you do something in the evening that's spiritual, it helps you in the morning. You know, if you watch a horror movie at night and then go to sleep, probably not a good idea. Of course, if your life's a horror movie, then you have to change that, change the channel. But anything you can do, if you do a little chanting or reading spiritual books at night, that helps you. In the morning, it's easier. So anything you can do that will support your chanting will make it easier, and you do get more benefit. So it's also another thing that's interesting that happens, I think, in relation to what you were saying about watching the mind, is that chanting is a purifying process. And so you know when you're sick and you have a fever and you're coughing, and what is often happening is, what's happening to your body? Why is your body doing that?
Get rid of the toxins.
Get rid of the toxins, yeah. Like, you know, a lot of times when people have colds, they say take antihistamines or have flus, but you should just let it come out. It's not good. You should let it come out. So the poison's coming out. Or if you fast, sometimes you get sick because poisons come out. So chanting is like that also. But sometimes you're chanting and then you'll start to see something about yourself that's not pleasant. To start to confront it. So there can be a dark night of the soul and a very blissful experience within the same period of chanting. And it's not something bad. If you see that happen, then you should know it's actually good. It means something is coming out. As we discussed yesterday on the chart, all the things down here, the selfishness, the duplicity, the lust, the greed, the envy, and all that, you might start to see more of that when you're chanting, because it's coming up, and you're becoming more self-reflective. A lot of this exists within us and we don't recognize it, and chanting helps you confront it and recognize it. And it's not bad, because what a lot of us do, we don't recognize it, so we deny it, we bury it, pretend it's not there, and so it's still there and we don't deal with it. So chanting often brings it up, and a lot of times when people chant, they feel that their chanting must be bad because it's bringing up something bad, but it's actually working. That's how it works. So sometimes the bliss comes through the back door. And, but when it's like when there's pain in your body, if you have a thorn and you remove the thorn, you feel better. So it's part of the process. It's hurting, but it's also cleansing. So that's just something to expect, or maybe not expect, but if it does happen, don't get worried. Don't call up your therapist. Mm-hmm. It's actually working. Yes?
I was having a thought while you were speaking about concentration, because I have found that there's like a competition the material energy is competing for our consciousness. So finding a sacred space or finding a place where you can concentrate is actually, it's hard sometimes because things are competing for your brain.
To get in your place.
Right. Yeah. Because everybody wants a bit of the action, right? Your cell phone rings and then there's a text message here, you have mail. And you know, if you're really lucky and you have an iPhone, then every minute of the day there's somebody pulling on you. And what to speak of your appointments, and oh my God, it's almost 10 o'clock, I have this, I have a class, my mother, I have to cook, I have to clean, oh gosh, what do I have to do today? So there's things pulling your consciousness all day, people pulling your consciousness in billboards and everywhere you draw, all over the place, for your eyes, for your ears. So to really take control or to grab your mind and your senses requires a conscious act. You really have to
It's a very good point. Because otherwise, what can happen is you'll just be distracted and you'll chant and you won't really feel anything because you're not taking it properly. And there's another point as far as distraction. What I found is distractions which exist externally also exist internally. So you may remove yourself from external distraction and internally you may be thinking about your voicemail, your email, the people you're supposed to call.
People actually get nervous when they don't know if they have an email.
So, I mean, definitely there's things we're addicted to in this world. And so those addictions, when we're chanting, they may come up. So in creating a sacred environment externally, you also have to do that internally. So like you say, the intention. Without the intention, it's very easy to be distracted. And just to be able to do that a little bit every day, you'll have such a positive experience that it'll be easier to extend it. So maybe you chant one round and you extend it. Because you'll want to do it. Otherwise, what can happen is you're going to try to find time to do it, and it's hard to find time to do something unless you really want to do it. Like one person, he was not chanting his committed number of rounds. So they brought it up to his spiritual master, and my spiritual master said, does he have time to eat? Said, is he missing any meals? Said, no. Is he missing his sleep? Said, no. But he's missing his chanting. So if something is not an absolute priority, it's hard to get to it because there are other things we want to do. So in spiritual practice, there's this form of self-discipline where you have to kind of restrict what you want to do right now to do something that's really ultimately more important. And we'll talk about that in a minute. And that's always going to be there on the beginning level, the intermediate, the elevated level. So carving, like you say, is a very good point. Carving out the space is only half of it. Getting in the space is the other half. And then not only being externally in the space, but being internally in the space. Okay. That's why we recommend doing it in the morning before your day starts, because the more you're removed from your day, the easier it is to focus. The closer it gets, the more you start thinking about it. So one of the intentions that I make when I chant is not to bring my day from the past or the future into my chanting. During that time, that stays out. It's like I create an internal like fence, and I'm inside, and these other things aren't allowed in. It's an internal meditation. So it's not enough just to create the space. Yes?
I was just going to say that we live in a society that's very rational. Especially with Facebook and all the social networking and reality TV and all that. It's like, there's a very strong sense of how people should act. We say we're an open-minded society, and yet, it's a very... I guess that's probably something you're going to touch on. But what I was going to say was that what I really like about chanting is that I find it very unique as an experience because it's very immersive in an internal way. is at an experiential level, there's a lot of things to immerse yourself into in the external world. But there's very little to immerse ourselves in the inner world. There's a lot of inner logic and inner emotions and all that, but I can't think of many things that are like an inner experience that you can kind of almost like lose yourself in a meditative way.
Yeah, and also because we're trained to look for experience outside ourselves, sensual stimuli, which also creates, I mean, your point is well taken, but it also creates a little bit of a challenge for us who are conditioned to experience everything that we can touch and taste and smell, because internally it's a different experience.
Well, that's why I think a lot of people don't even want to take up chanting as an experience, just because it goes against everything we're told that, you know, can be an experience, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just nobody thinks of the chanting can be an experience. It's like, I just had a recent that had this experience. I was talking to a psychologist, and I was explaining to him how much chanting means to me. And it's just very interesting. He kept on trying to break it down at a mechanistic level. You know, he'd say, oh, well, yeah, it's the data, this, that, it's the accolades. And I was, you know, I said, well, you know, obviously you don't subscribe to my paradigm. And, you know, I respect
that.
But, you know, the words you're using doesn't describe the quality of my experience, you know.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I guess, you know, you're inclined to write me off as a religious person or spiritual person who's irrational or, you know, whatever words you use. But it's just, I mean, I hope you don't mind that, you know, I don't share your opinion about, you know, my experience.
It's a transcendental experience.
Yeah, I mean, just at a qualitative level, it's just there's nothing that science produces that can give me that level of experience.
Yeah. Well, this is a good point. So we're gonna, this is leading right into where we're gonna go now. So, I want to take your lead and continue the discussion we had yesterday briefly about happiness. You remember we were talking about higher levels of consciousness and how that, the virtues of those higher levels, is the source of happiness, your own consciousness. Remember the potato play we did? You weren't here for the potato play, but potato play is the teacher tells the students to write on potatoes all the people they hate, and they have to bring the potatoes to class, and she makes them carry the potatoes with them for a week, 24 hours a day, and they're complaining all week. And finally, on the last day, they put the potatoes down, and she says, just see. What's like when you carry hatred in your heart? It's the same. So we had discussed that. And the concept of happiness, which eludes so many of us, although that's all we're really trying for. I mean, if you look at your life, you're not really trying to suffer. Even if you are suffering, it's not that you're trying, it's just circumstantial. You're trying to avoid suffering. Even if you're working at a job you don't like, you're doing it because ultimately you need or want the income so you can be happy. So directly or indirectly, we're not doing anything to cause ourselves suffering, only to avoid pain and be happy. Considering that, I had a friend who's a doctor who told me something. It's quite astounding. It was hard to believe. He said, he just came from Cincinnati. He lives here now. And he said, in my practice in Cincinnati, 50% of my patients were on antidepressants. I said, wow, Cincinnati must be a pretty bad city. He goes, no, it's a nice city. I was thinking, you know, like Detroit, it's close to Detroit, or, you know, Flint, Michigan. It must be, like, really bad there. He goes, no, it's a nice city. I said, 50%. And then I saw a video, which I can't show you because the video player I brought last night and left in the car that's not here, the absent-minded professor, did it again. But in it, it said that about 30% of children were on, you know, either had attention deficit disorder or on antidepressants. So, and when I tell people I'm always happy, nobody believes me. I said, no, no, no. You can't always be happy. It's not the way the world works. And I said, well, if you don't do anything to make yourself miserable, then you can always be happy. So I want to discuss this concept because it's explained in the book Bhagavad Gita. And it's explained in a very interesting way. And it said there are different kinds of happiness in this world. So I wanted to explain. And there's also the happiness that Pradyumna is explaining, which is not of this world. So there's gradations of happiness. Some happiness in this world is better and some is worse. So I want to explain it. It's a very interesting dynamic. So, how many of you have heard the word sattva? Sattva, sattvic. Have you ever heard the word sattvic?
Yeah.
Sattvic means, the translation in Sanskrit means goodness, sattvic or sattvic, things which are good. And raja, or rajasic, raja means passion. And tama, tamasic, or tamasic, tamasic means ignorance. And in the Bhagavad Gita, it says that everything we do, everything we think, all our activities, even our faith, our spiritual practices, our material activities, are influenced by one of these three modes. Generally, it's a combination, but predominantly one of these three modes. They're called guna in Sanskrit. Guna means mode or rope. And so it said there's happiness in three modes. So we're going to describe this, and it's very interesting. And the first mode is tama. So what does tama mean? Who remembers?
Ignorance.
So, we do a continuum of happiness. Well, I should have drawn that lower. Anyway, in Tamaguna, the mode of ignorance, it's described that in the continuum of happiness, you experience pain or misery. We'll say, I'm going to call this stages. You'll understand better when we explain the others, the stages. There are different stages you go through in achieving happiness. Sometimes you don't get it right away, right? You got to work, and then you get it. So happiness comes in different stages. It said in the mode of ignorance, you get pain and misery in all stages, which is an interesting concept. Because naturally you think, well, why would I do anything which causes me pain? And we have to explore this. What does this mean? Well, think of an example of a man who's cheating on his wife. And he's got a date after work with his mistress. And his wife calls him up and says, what time are you coming home, honey? The kids really want to see you. They haven't seen you all day. And he says, well, unfortunately, I'm working late in the office. I won't be home till 9 o'clock. Right? So he just gets this call from his mistress, from his wife, and he's on the way to see his mistress. So you could imagine he's feeling a bit uneasy or uncomfortable, feeling guilty. He knows it's the wrong thing. There's some attachment there, right? So the whole, then he goes, sees his mistress, does whatever he does. So that whole experience, underlining that experience at every stage, is this feeling of guilt that I shouldn't be doing this. It's the wrong thing. And we often have that. I mean, guilt is an emotion which comes up when we're doing something that's wrong. And we know it's wrong. But we often do it anyway, even though we know. The voice is there. Don't do this. It's wrong. It's not right. So through his experience on every level, he can't really fully enjoy it because there's pain. There's intense guilt, or perhaps there's remorse. I think an even probably more vivid example would be an alcoholic. Because what alcoholism does to someone is it ruins their life, or drug addiction. And if you know anybody or seen anybody who's an alcoholic or a drug addict, it ruins their life. And so a lot of times they're out doing illegal things to get money to support their habit, or they're just begging on the street, they're living on the street. But when you see them and you'll say, are you happy? Oh yeah, I'm happy. You know, face has got cuts all over it. He's just, you know, where are you sleeping tonight? Oh, find some place to sleep, you know, whatever. And we're looking at them and thinking, this person's not happy, they're miserable. But they're thinking they're happy. But their happiness just involves misery. It's an addiction. Their life has been ruined by it, totally. And that's their so-called happiness. So, in the mode of ignorance, you'll find that there's pain involved. And I'll give you an example, a visual example. So why don't you close your eyes and imagine, if you like, imagine a dessert. Your favorite dessert. Whatever it might be. I'll imagine a banana split with whipped cream, cherries, and ground walnuts. Maybe some chocolate fudge over it. So you imagine, you can imagine that or imagine your favorite. And you imagine the dish that it's in, the table that it's on. And just look at it in detail, whatever it is you're looking at. Your cake, your ice cream, your sundae. And you're really hungry and this is your favorite dessert and you can't wait to eat it. And you just, your mouth is watering. And you pick up the spoon. It's my favorite. I'm starving. I've been thinking about eating this all day. Pick up your spoon. Put your spoon deep into it. Big spoonful. And put it in your mouth. And you start tasting your favorite flavors. The whipped cream, the chocolate, the cherries, the nuts, whatever it is. And a few seconds later, you realize that they put salt in it instead of sugar. And you're tasting these familiar flavors that you love so much, but it's salty, and you're trying to enjoy it, but you can't because it's salty. And that's what you call in English a bummer. So sometimes life is like that, in that there's something wrong and we're trying to enjoy something and there's salt in it, but we're attached to what, you know, I'm attached to the whipped cream and the chocolate, and I like the taste, but there's salt in it, and I don't know if you've ever had this experience. Have you ever eaten something that didn't taste good and you ate a lot of it because you wanted it to taste good? You ever had that experience? Some happiness in that mode is something like that. So, can anyone else think of an example that might illustrate this kind of happiness, where there's some pleasure, but it's so much covered with pain in each stage of it, in the beginning, the middle, the end? Can someone think of another example? What might be like that? Losing your money in Las Vegas? The thrill of gambling? But as you're gambling, money keeps going, so you're not too happy about that.
Having an intimate relationship with a tar baby.
Intimate relationship with a tar baby.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Can't be too close to it to get sticky. You can't fight it and punch it to get sticky. You know, there's no getting away from it. Sometimes I'm the problem, like, I seem to get into it.
Oh yeah, the more you try to solve it, the worse it gets.
Yeah, I mean, the only solution becomes detachment, you know? It's like, you can't really hate it, because, you know, just fighting it just gets you more embroiled in tar baby's drama, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can't love it because it's like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. You try to make it better and you make it worse.
Yeah, I mean, any association with it kind of sucks you in.
This is such an interesting phenomenon. It's
I think the best way I could say it is happiness that isn't happiness. I mean, there's some perception of pleasure, but it's so, there's so much pain involved in it.
You know, sometimes you might work for something and it's so difficult to achieve and it's just causing you so much anxiety. And so through the whole process, you're not happy. But you're being alerted on by some little vague experience of what you might perceive as happiness in some way. But there's much more pain involved. So, I think I have more examples if I could find where I wrote them. Let's see if I have any. Oh yeah, there's another example of happiness in the mode of ignorance. It tends to bring your consciousness down. Rather, like we were saying yesterday, virtuous activities elevate your consciousness. It tends to cause your consciousness to go down. Someone who's involved in cheating people to make a living. It might be filled with guilt, so the happiness is mixed with intense amounts of guilt. So, can any of you think of an example right now? Write down an example from your own life where, well, let me give you another example. It might help. Have you ever done something, let's say you like to bike ride, but you've hurt your hip. You fell down and you hurt your hip. So when you're riding the bike, it's painful. But this weekend, all your friends are going on this big bike ride and you're looking forward to it for months. And it's the big thing and it's the who's who of bike riding. So you want to go. So you get on your bike and you're with the group and you're enjoying the camaraderie and so forth. But every time you pedal, there's pain in your... And so the whole thing, the whole enjoyment is ruined by the pain of it. That's another example. It's just miserable all the way through. Strange example. So why don't you just think for a moment and see if you can think of an example from your life, either present or past, where you did something where there was pain involved in. I mean, I wouldn't say necessarily you can come up with something that great, but think of anything you've done, there may have been pain involved all the way through. There's so the second level of happiness is where the pain comes later and the happiness comes first. This is where it's just difficult all the way through. Write down if you can think of something.
I think one important aspect of pain and ignorance is that it ends up in misery also.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you say no pain, no gain. So you have pain, but then the end is good.
Yeah. Yeah.
The end is not worth it.
Yeah, and the happiness you described is the sattva happiness. Pain produces good, and we'll talk about that. And passion, you get happiness first, you get pain later. But in this mode, it starts in pain, the middle is pain, and you never get out, you never actually have an experience of real enjoyment because there's always something wrong. You're out of balance. It could be a relationship where the relationship was never right. You ever see these people, you know, they say, oh, we're engaged, we're going to get married. And the whole day they're arguing. You're like, you're going to get married? It's like, what's wrong with you? You could see that their relationship has just been pain all the way through. So write down something that you can think of.
Sometimes I wonder, in this world, it's almost like somewhat of an advantage to be insensitive. And let me explain, what I mean by that. Because it's like, I guess as spiritualists, or, people trying to practice spirituality or interested in their parents, we're kind of sensitive to, let's say, ignorance or passion or, the different types of happiness and things. And you see people who kind of just, I almost in some ways envy them, they don't need to seem to be aware, and they kind of continue doing the same thing, and it's like, wow, I don't know.
We'll talk about that later. Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah.
For a while.
Yeah.
But it also goes back to the other point of confronting the reality of the situation. We're going to talk about that later. So write down something. If there is something you can think of. Have a lung disease and you're smoking, it's worsening the disease, there's pain involved. We've all done this before. At least now we're aware of it. Okay. So, as we said here, happiness that isn't really happiness, that is tamagun. There's so much pain involved in happiness. It's a stupid way to try to be happy, and I wanted to read a quote from my good friend Albert Schweitzer. Or was it Einstein? Einstein, he said, only two things are infinite in this world, the universe and human stupidity. So when we're disconnected from our spiritual self, this world makes us do. We do stupid things. And human stupidity is infinite. Okay, so now we're going to go to the next stage. And that is called Raja. Who remembers what Raja means?
Passion.
So we'll choose red for passion, right? Is that good? Now I have to clarify what, because passion is not always bad. You can be passionate about good things. So, this is more of an impetuous type of passion. Or just, you know, the wanting to have everything and just not really using your intelligence so much and just very actively grabbing as much as you can get. Right? You've got 100 years to live, get as much as you can. Yeah. So, you could be very passionate about saving the world. That's a different kind of passion. This is self-centered. So it's really, this is, how should we say it? For those practicing spiritual life, this is where the real distraction of the world comes in passion. I want more. That's passion. But the passion manifests in happiness in that. The misery comes here, in the end. And the happiness, or as it's described in the Gita, they use another word for happiness, which is nectar. You pay misery, poison. Gita describes the nectar becomes poison. So it's kind of the buy now, pay later. Right? You everything's good here. You're happy, but it turns. I think the most typical example of this would be relationships that were good at one point that become the sources of pain. It's the most typical example of passion, or very vivid example of passion. Anyone ever experienced that? Or should I say that again? Anybody not experienced that? Or some good relationship, something happened? Who could think of another example? Something good turns bad.
Well, just like if you buy a car, in the beginning you have this car and it's great, take it everywhere, and then it starts to disintegrate, take all your money, half your time, and ultimately it's just the source of anxiety.
Or they come out next year.
It's a source of anxiety for the whole world because there's so many cars and then there's pollution and there's roads and there's traffic.
That's part of the phenomenon of entropy, where you try to improve something and it gets worse.
Conforming to social norms.
That tell you that this will make you happy?
To the point of denying your individuality and your individual needs. So, I mean, we say that no man is an island or lives in a vacuum. So
That could border on ignorance.
For career purposes or for, just making your livelihood. I mean, just, I guess, having a social life, having whatever, being a part of a family. I mean, you kind of touched on that, I think, yesterday. Just sort of standards and whatnot. And we want that relationship. We want that acceptance. We want that positive. And but it's like, at a certain point, we kind of almost deny ourselves a certain, essence of what we are. And I guess perhaps that's where a lot of the depression and things come from.
Yeah, it's a big cause of depression. Trying to live according to others' expectations of you. Which I think another example you reminded me of is just career choice. This was the career I chose that turned out to be not what I really want to do. It's very typical, right? Or the job you got. I finally got the job. And then what happens? It's not the way you thought. Now, that's why there's a saying, the grass is greener on the other side. It's from these experiences. So generally what people tend to think is, because this happens so much to us, we tend to look at other people and think it doesn't happen to them. They're happy and I'm not. But I'm just here to let you know, of course, it's not that we should enjoy other people's misery, but misery does love company. And just to let you know, this is a phenomenon of this world when people are basing their happiness on setting things up externally the way they want. Things tend to shift, right? And they don't always stay the same way. And so this is very common. This is one of the most common forms of happiness. It was great. Everything was great. And then something went wrong. Or, you had?
I just had an example.
Yeah.
So I'm a writer. And when I write a piece, I feel it's a spiritual experience for me. And I get, fulfillment from that. And I wish it was just that. But then when it's done, I want people to pat me on the back and tell me I'm a genius. So sometimes it happens when they say, what are you going to do next? And then I was like, oh gosh, I have to produce something really great. So it's no longer a conversation with me and Krishna. It's, what am I going to do to please these people? And I'll never make it again. And so it's, happiness, and then it's terrible.
Well, I think that's a great point, because you're saying you want recognition. So when you bring that desire in there, desires, you be very careful with your desires, because desires are really, can really put you down the, put you down there very quickly. Just the desire to be acknowledged and recognized and approved and appreciated. It's like you go around with a scorecard, right? How many points did I get today? You can take that into other examples in terms of desire for wealth. That your standard may be, I want to make $1 million a month. If I don't make $1 million a month, I'm not, I got an MBA, I've gone to Harvard Business School. That's the standard. If you're smart, you should make that much money. Obviously, you don't need that much, but that's just, then we become impelled by that. And there are people like that who make that much money who are totally depressed because they're not making as much as Bill Gates or Warren Buffett. They're like, I should be making like $30 billion a year. I've been to Harvard Business School. I'm smart. And so they're creating a standard. So you've like created a standard, okay? And by that standard, you've built in misery to your the self-sabotage. You had something?
I was just thinking of the whole mortgage thing. Because so many, I mean, ultimately you see it, what happens in the whole country.
Yeah.
But, you know, that didn't happen until a few years ago. So for how many ever long it was, people are thinking they can live on plastic or they can, you know, have a house that they don't really have.
Mm-hmm.
And it you can, you know, impress the Joneses with the beauty right. of your place yeah. and maybe even impress yourself and your family, but you don't really own it. And then eventually it
right.
causes misery.
Right.
You have to pay for it. The whole economy just went
to I think at this point, because of the time factor, why don't you all write down examples? I think you probably more, a little easier to write down examples in this category. Write down examples in your own life that are currently happening or have happened in the past where something good went south of the border. And you also may want to know why, like in your case, that was a good point. Pride entered, expectation entered, what entered? What may have entered? It may be the nature of the activity, like the car is going to break down eventually, but it may, you may have had something to do with it. Anybody writing a biography right now?
My whole life is an ample of this.
Now, I want to encourage you, or I want to give you some encouraging words. If this is happening to you, it's actually good. We'll talk about why it's good. If you're in the mode of ignorance or the mode of passion, it's good. And there's a reason it's good. It doesn't feel good, but it is good. So this requires a bit of subtle intelligence to understand. This next one. This is called Satvagun. And this is called goodness. and the way it's described in Bhagavad Gita, that in Satvagun, you'll do something which you may not want to do, which requires self-discipline, particularly doing things which will elevate you spiritually, or doing things which will elevate you to this higher level, virtuous activity, that requires some form of putting off what you'd rather do now for a higher purpose. So your immediate experience is not pleasure, but your immediate experience is, I'm like, I don't want to do this. This is not, I don't like this. And you'll find this a lot when you're practicing chanting, when you're trying to control the mind. The mind is, it can be extremely painful. In fact, sometimes people chant and they just go to sleep. And one of the reasons they go to sleep, because it requires so much energy to focus the mind, they don't have it. And it just kind of, instead of the chanting elevating them, it's counterproductive. So when you make a sacrifice for a higher position, when you discipline yourself, like we talked yesterday about getting up early, right? That I used to go to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. And then I moved in the ashram and had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. So that happiness that I experienced from doing that, it didn't take place at 4 o'clock in the morning. It was not an immediate experience of happiness. The happiness came as a byproduct later. Whereas in Rajagun, the happiness is immediate. You get it right away. It tastes good, it looks good. Let's go do this. Hey, we're having exams on Monday. Forget it. Let's go to the party. You know, and then you go in to take your exams. You know, you study for an hour Sunday night. You're tired. You know, and you go and take your exams. You don't do well. So you had a good time on the weekend, but you suffered because it required some discipline. I shouldn't go to the party. I should study. So particularly Satvagun, as explained in the Bhagavad Gita, is really activities which lead you up towards the spiritual. It's all the activities that will take you towards the spiritual. So things like discipline, self-control, all the things that are, I don't want to do that. All the things that are more difficult are the things that produce the enduring happiness in the end. So it's just switched from sattva to rajas. And rajas, you get it right away. You don't have to pay anything. Right? Just throw out your credit card. You got it. You walk out of the store, you didn't feel the pain. You don't feel the pain until when? Until you get your statement. And you go, oh my God, how come it's so much? Yeah, the late fee and the interest. And yeah, then the pain continues, right? But you immediately get it. You don't have to do anything. Or you do it the other way. Say, no, I'll just buy with cash and I'll work and work and I'll save and save. And I could spend all this money, but I'm saving and saving it. So I'm depriving myself of something to get something greater. So this is, for those practicing spiritual life, Satvagun is very important. Because oftentimes you're going to do spiritual practice and you won't feel anything. Say, I didn't feel anything. But you do it because you know it's the right thing to do. And gradually, what do you experience? You experience happiness. What kind of happiness? You feel peaceful. Symptoms of Satvagun. You feel very calm. When you're in Satvagun, it's not like you're out at the mall shopping. I have to have this, I have to have that. I don't have enough. See, Rajagun is the programming, which Lakshmimani is going to talk about shortly, is the program we get. Because Rajagun helps the economy. Because you can't have at least the way our economy is set up, you can't have a successful economy unless people feel like they don't have enough. Because if everyone practiced spiritual life and everyone was satisfied, right? So many stores would go out of business. Because most of what we buy, we don't need. We just buy because we want. Whenever my sister wanted to buy something, my father would say, do you need it or do you just want it? because he was raised in the Depression, so that's how he thought. As he was programmed to think, well, if you don't need it, don't buy it. Why waste the money? So the way our economy works, we're programmed to think more is better, right? If I have a 1,000-square-foot apartment, a 2,000-square-foot apartment would be better. If I have a 4-cylinder car, a 6-cylinder would be better. If I have an old computer, a faster computer would be better. That's our programming. Where did the programming come? Just look at any magazine and read the subliminals there. More is better. And part of more is better is you don't have enough. And that programming is going within all of us. And that's where the motive passion exists. And that's how our economy exists. And so we're all caught up in that. And so therefore, and then what about you poor girls? When you look at the magazine covers of all these fashion magazines, then it's like, that's like, that should be illegal. It's just like massive torture of women in the world. They're being tortured by these models that don't look like that. They don't look like that at all. And it's creating all kinds of problems because now you think I'm supposed to look like that. God forbid you're 3 pounds overweight. You know, that's like enough reason to kill yourself, right? You know, in the turn of the century, they used to have medicine to make women fat because fat was sexy, because thin was equated with poverty. Do you know that at one point, being very, very white skin was considered beautiful because having a suntan was equated with poverty because it was the peasants that worked in the fields that had the suntans? So you see how the culture manipulates us? So now, being underweight is sexy, right? In India, if you go on a train, everybody's skinny, and you go on an airplane, everybody's fat, because the people on the train can't afford to eat rich food. I swear, I've studied this. You go on the plane, every last person, fatso, in India. It's like, what happened, you know? All the thin people, you know, they ended up on the train, all the fat people ended up on the airplane. I mean, it's not 100% that way, but it's very much, you notice a difference. You know, because in a poor country, you have to have a lot of money to get fat.
I have a really quick point about that. I just went to India this summer, and right before I left, my dad was telling me to eat a lot more. He's like, you have to do this. And he understands that I'm exercising for my health, and he understands that, but he says in India, they don't understand that. And that's the same exact thing that happened. I went there. I think for every day, they're just trying to feed me more. They're saying, yeah, I don't understand. How are you in America and you're this skinny? Like, they just don't understand what it equates
to. And then, so being a little chubby there is considered beautiful, right?
Yeah.
It's, we were wealthy. And, So wherever we go, we're being programmed. Yeah. So this is what we're up against. And now you're trying to practice spiritual life, and you're being programmed. So I think this is a good time for you to show us how we're being programmed. So why don't we trade seats?
You want me to try to set up your...
We've got some... She brought some slides. Keep us awake and entertained.
I really didn't get a whole lot because they didn't tell me until yesterday.
So. But anyway.
It's open on the PowerPoint. It's pretty easy to see what it is. But the point that's being made is that I have a quote on there, whatever comes up, and it says, when I was 5, my mother told me that the purpose of life is to be happy. Then when I went to school, my teacher asked me, what are you going to be when you grow up? Or what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, happy. And they said, you didn't understand the question. And I said to them, you don't understand the purpose of life. So when I saw that quote, I thought, this is interesting. How does this thing work? This is too hard to get for me. I thought, it's interesting, a concept that we all want to be happy. And it's true, we all want to be happy. But the question is, what is happiness? And so if we look here, we see there are different levels of happiness. But we're programmed, almost inadvertently, we're programmed to consider what happiness is, what it looks like. How do we recognize? How do we know we're happy? Not only how do we know we're happy, but how do other people know we're happy? because most people aren't happy to be happy alone. They want other people to think they're really happy. We don't like it when people know we're unhappy or sad. So the media is a multi-billion dollar organization which is geared specifically to teach us what happiness is. And the reason is only one. Anybody have an idea what the one reason media teaches us about happiness? Why? Why are they telling us what happiness is?
They want us to be consumers.
They want us to be consumers. Or they want to make money. They want to make money off of us. Somehow or other, they want to make money off of us. And whatever they see is a little bit attractive, they package it and then sell it to you. For instance, let's think about greenness. Green. Everything's green now. You can go to the bank and the checks are green. And I'm in the Brahma Jyoti.
Yeah,
everything's actually blue. It's not green. I'm in the light. I saw the
you're
light.
Have to,
I'm
you can have to sign somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah. I don't know where.
You have a pocket?
No. It's okay. I'll
hold it.
And there it is. It's beautiful, isn't it? The fact is that everything, yoga, right? The purpose of yoga, maybe you've been talking a little bit about here, bhakti yoga, what is yoga? Yoga is designed to help us control our mind, to become spiritual, to look inside for happiness, to actually pull our senses away from false kinds of happiness, from happiness and passion and ignorance, and even sometimes in goodness there are pitfalls. So we want to pull away, but now people are selling us yoga. Right? They're selling us yoga for material purpose. It's a huge business. Let's, you know, sell you maps, and we'll sell you blocks, and we'll sell you... Not only that, but we'll sell you who you are. Like he was just talking about it. We'll sell you what you should look like. Right? We'll sell you how you should act, what the good qualities are, and what the bad qualities are. When I walked in, I was looking at this list behind me now about... You know, the good qualities and the bad qualities. And I looked at the word humility. And I said, well, how do they feel about humility? Because in our society, humility isn't a cherished quality. If you write on your resume that you're humble, people aren't going to think it's great, right? But if you write on your resume that you're somewhat aggressive or you're dynamic or you're enthusiastic, people will go for that. Competitive, right? You write on your resume, I'm competitive, I like to be on top. People will appreciate. But if you write on your resume that you're humble, people think, oh, it's a doormat. Not a good thing. Okay, back up.
Should we move it over?
First here? We got to clear it up because it's very...
Mother Lakshmi.
Fuzzy.
On that note, can I say
something? Sure.
It's a very interesting experience that I have on that notion. Was that in, let's say, in,
I can sit here.
Whatever you want.
Oh,
sorry.
You can't see.
You can be very good.
It's called plan ahead.
Go ahead, Bridget. I'm sorry.
No, what I was saying was that, on the subject of humility, that what I found was very interesting was that in the East, traditionally, subservience, humility is considered a good quality. And whereas in the West, generally, what I find is doing job interviews and stuff, assertiveness like that is considered good qualities. For example, how a person shakes your hand, you determine, right? And so here it's like, and what's very interesting is, I've worked in software companies for a while, and there's a lot of the Indian candidates that come that they kind of err on the side of being humble. And so in that way, they're almost like not taken seriously because it's almost an indication of a lack of confidence. Whereas, if in India somebody acts all brash, then it's a sign of arrogance and a sign of that you're probably going to be a troublemaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so these, that, so from that we can pull that the media is culturally tied, right? What the messages that the media gives you or the messages that the culture gives you, they come different in different places. So when you transplant yourself from one place to another, then you have to become aware of the messages that are being given you. For now, if we look at how do we determine what happiness is, can you go to the next one? Yeah, this is the quote I was telling you. When I was 5 years old, my mom told me again and again that happiness was the key to life. And when I went to school, they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I wrote down happy. They told me I didn't understand the assignment, and I told them they didn't understand life. But the question comes, what is happiness? How elusive is that thing? You want to go to the next slide? So here's happiness in the mode of goodness. You see the statue of happiness at the bottom of her feet. It says also the statue of happiness. It's the American standard, right? The Statue of Liberty stands before us and tells us we can be happy. We can achieve anything we want. That's the American dream. Whatever you want, you can have it. Do you feel like that? Do you really feel like that? That you can have anything you want? That somehow America is going to unpackage some dream for you? We have this vision of happiness family running through the nature. There's somebody meditating. There's a happy family with a child. So these kind of conceptions of happiness are given to us in our culture, and we grow up with them. And we imbibe them within our heart as what happiness is, what good happiness, because we're talking about sattvic happiness, what it looks like. Now maybe happiness is somewhat changed, right? Good happiness may not look like this in America anymore. We may not have this. Maybe we don't have a marriage anymore. Maybe that's passé now, and the idea is to just have partners, you know, significant others periodically, and maybe children aren't part of the whole thing, or maybe we don't raise them because we don't have time, right? So happiness may look like a big job or something. So happiness will change for us in the mode of goodness. It doesn't hurt other people, right? Mode of goodness, happiness, you feel good and you do good for others. You don't hurt other people. Mode of goodness, happiness comes out all right in the end. It's the story that has the happy ending. And then trying to understand what that is, we have many, many difficulties because media is constantly giving us different messages. You'll be happy if you're Miss America. You'll be happy if you have many partners, male or female. You'll be happy if you're successful. So happiness is given to us in different stages, and these are kind of goodness happinesses. They're happinesses that don't cause disturbance. Can you go to the next one? But there's happiness in the mode of passion, which, as Mahatma Prabhu was saying, is much more prevalent in our society. The idea that you need something you don't have, and that's not only a tangible physical thing, it's a state of identity. Your identity is not complete. You need a different one. You need to look differently, if you need to act differently. Whatever it is, that if your hair is straight, you need it curly. If it's black, you need it blonde. If it's short, you need it long. If it's long, you need it short. I remember when I was a young girl, there were some singers that were very popular, Joan Baez and who else was there? Joan Baez, but they didn't have hair. There was Joan Baez and there was Peter, Paul, and Mary. And they had this long, straight hair. And so I used to iron my hair. I used to lay it down on an ironing board and iron it with an iron. And then, of course, there's people going, you know, to the beauty parlor and getting it all curled up, and they sit with these things on their head and they dye it all different colors. Because we think that whatever we are, it's not good enough. We have to be something else. So here you see passion in so many different... What is happiness? Well, happiness is money. Having a lot of money, right? An indication that you're successful, that you're happy, is that you can buy whatever it is that you think you want. And you can be sexy
or you can have a sexual relationship, which doesn't have responsibility, but it has pleasure. Right? Very often we find that what's touted now as a relationship now doesn't require responsibility. If you look at movies, messages in movies, right, and videos, you'll find that only 10% of them discuss in any way the consequences of your behavior. Everything just talks about do it, but it never says what's going to happen if you do it. What's going to happen to the children in a relationship that doesn't have any responsibility? These things are not discussed. So, I mean, talking about media in 20 minutes is like trying to pass physics with a one-day class. It's almost impossible. But just to get an idea, here you have these ladies. They've gone to the extreme, right? They're happy passionately. Eating. They like eating. They're having fun. They're happy. But then, look at them. Maybe we should put this in ignorance, because the suffering will come later for this behavior. Here's a child, and this says, it said have a rocking day. But here's a child, and he's already being trained up. And you may think this is exaggerated, it's an advertisement, but this is a reality. Children at a very young age already, they're working multiple different kinds of remote controls. They already know how to make a phone. My grandson is 3, and he already knows how to use an iPhone better than I do. I'm serious. He can find the game, you know, he just goes like this, and he finds his game, and he hits his game, and then he gives the words that spell and all this different thing. Already plugged in, tuned in, being trained from a very, very young age, already to consider that happiness means being connected, being plugged. And why do you want to be plugged, and why do you want to be connected? Because the next thing that will make you happy, you have to know about it, and you won't know about it unless you're connected. Because it changes. We were at the Big and Hardy Music Festival the other day, and I was surprised to see that everybody there had hula hoops. It was the new thing. Everybody was with hula hoops. They were selling them. They were using them. Hula hoops were popular when I was 5, and I'm 63 right now. So I haven't seen them in many, many years, but now they're back. Now, how would I know about that? Unless I'm connected somehow and I'm hearing from the powers that be, the messages that tell me what I'm supposed to look like, what am I supposed to buy, what's supposed to give me pleasure, what's popular, what's cool. Those things come to me by being connected. So now we find that society has sold us a concept of happiness which says you have to be connected all the time. You have to be connected all the time. iPod tells you have to be connected all the time. 24 hours a day, you have to be connected to somewhere. You have Wi-Fi. It's in the air. Open your computer on any street corner, practically. You can get online. Your machine that's in your pocket will beep at you. It will tell you, you need to be connected. There's a funny little clip of a young boy who decides he wants to study. He doesn't want to get distracted. So all his friends are on Facebook. Right, they're all on Facebook. And he walks into the room and he says, oh, look at all of you, you're all on Facebook. What are you doing with yourself? Why don't you do your homework? And they said, ah, oh, come on, you don't know what it's like. It's so much fun. We decided to make you a Facebook page as a gift. So we created a whole Facebook page for you, and here's the information. You can just go log on. I don't want to log on. I'm just going to do my work, forget it. I'm not into this stuff. So he goes home. He's sitting in his room studying, and his father's at the door, and his father says, I see you got a Facebook page. So he says, yeah, my friends made it for me. I don't even know about it. He said, you didn't make me your friend. The boy says, I don't have any friends. I didn't even do it. I didn't even look at it. Well, okay, if you don't want me to be a friend, that's fine. I mean, I'm only your father. He says, okay, I'll make you my friend. And then his father walks away, comes back in a few seconds, and he says, no, it's okay. If you don't want me to be your friend, I understand. But at least your grandmother, she's old and she may die. You should at least make her your friend. So he's okay. So then he goes to school, and he sees his girlfriend. His girlfriend says, I see you got a Facebook page. You don't like me anymore. He says, what do you mean? He says, well, you said on your Facebook page, that you're single. You didn't even write that you were in a relationship. So immediately he finds his whole life being controlled by this thing that's supposed to be creating for him happiness. And instead of creating happiness, it's controlling his life. So these messages that we get from media, from television, from pictures, and they're everywhere, right? I don't know if you can see this because it's kind of in the crack in the wall. But it says, this man is a glutton for happiness. And why? Because he has 10 cars. He has 10 cars. They're all parked over there, different kinds of Hondas or whatever. So these are the messages that we get, and we actually feel inferior. We actually feel disconnected. We actually feel dissatisfied if we're not moving to these standards of happiness, of activity, of social intercourse. Go to the next one. This is one of the biggest multi-million dollar advertising campaigns in the world. I don't know if you've seen it. It's everywhere. And it's called Open Happiness. That's the name of it. So it's a Coca-Cola thing. And they would like us to believe that if you just have Coca-Cola, then you'll be happy. Right? But if you talk about pain at the beginning, pain in the middle, and pain at the end, what do you get out of this? 1 minute it's there, it's not good for you, it rots your teeth. If you read about it, you'll see that if you put a bottle of Coca-Cola, the contents of a bottle of Coca-Cola on a car battery, it will destroy the nodes of the car battery, it will eat away at the metal. It'll make it feel good. No. So it's not good for you. It's not good for you. And it doesn't do anything. And at the end, what happens? It's finished, and you have to just buy more. But open happiness everywhere. So many. I could have done a whole 2-hour slideshow just on the different pictures that go in this ad. Here's another one. Happiness is just around the corner. It's just around the corner. And the animals are running just around the corner. Buy more things. The sexiest rats are here. Right? So stay ahead of the rat race. Soft, silky, creamy. These words, these symbols, this energy is what moves our society around. And we keep going. We keep going again and again. And then here, ultimately, these people intoxicated. Right? We see that here in the campus, isn't it? But people, just 1 second. They think, they're happy. Look at those girls. They look happy. Right? They are drinking. They are having a good time. And they are happy. And then, what happens to them afterwards? They don't look so happy up above. And what to speak is if they got in a car accident or whatever, then they really wouldn't be happy. But these kind of messages run our lives unless we can pull away from them. It's interesting how in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks all about bhakti yoga, and he tells us about the nature of the relationship in yoga, in bhakti, and how it gives us a kind of happiness which never ends. It's eternal. And it's the only source of a happiness which never ends, because everything in the material world ends by definition. But happiness that comes from our spiritual relationships with the absolute truth or with divine, that happiness is eternal. Now he says in those chapters where he talks about bhakti and love of God and developing our spiritual practice, he says these are the most confidential knowledge, the highest knowledge. And then in the next chapter after that section, it talks about the three modes of material nature and being entangled in these goodness, passion, and ignorance. They're compared to ropes. Actually, that word guna means ropes. So they've talked about like how we get tied up in those ropes. And in that chapter, he says, now I'm going to tell you knowledge, which is more valuable than any other that you have. And you think, well, wait a minute. You just told me about my relationship with God and divinity and practicing, you know, spiritual life. And you said that was the most confidential knowledge. And now you're telling me knowledge about these three modes of material nature is the most valuable knowledge. How does that work? And well, it works because, let's say I said to you, I'm going to give you a huge plate of food that is so good. It's all the things that you like. The only thing is I'm going to put it outside the room, and you're going to be locked inside it. I have the key. You don't have it. So now you have a problem, right? The food is there. You can have it, but you are prevented from getting it because you're locked in the room. And you don't have the key. So knowledge about how to get that key is going to be the most important knowledge that you can have. It's more important than getting money. It's more important than being beautiful. It's more important than finding a good husband. If you don't know how to get out of that room, you're in big trouble. And not only that, but you can't even eat the feast. So whatever knowledge I can give you about how to get that key, that's the most important knowledge. And so in these chapters, Krishna tells us how to get out of the effect of these modes of material nature. And it's the most valuable knowledge, because you'll see when you try to chant, when you try to be spiritual, when you try to practice, you're going to be tied by these ropes. And these ropes will try to prevent you from focusing on your spiritual quest. So until you learn how to deal with these ropes and get out of them, it's going to be very hard, very difficult. So media is everywhere. It's ubiquitous, right? Wherever you go, all over the place, in your face, all over the place. You can't avoid it. Who can give me some examples of media that... You can shut this off, Prabhu. Can you give me some examples? Well, actually, there's one more slide, just of ignorance. I don't want to sort of stay in ignorance. But there's another one. Happiness is being loved by a Labrador. Here's this nice guy. He's got his hamburger with him. So these are ideas of what it's like to be happy. What is media? Where do you find it? Maybe you don't think you're affected by it. Maybe it's not in your house. How many of you have a television set? How many of you have a computer? How many of you have a device that is a phone and also gets you on the internet sometimes? Takes pictures now? Okay, what other media is there? Let's say you're relatively free, right? All you have is your computer and you only do homework. So maybe you're not affected by media, you think?
T-shirts.
Billboards. Magazines.
Newspapers. Pictures everywhere, and even, you know, people walking down the street, walking billboards. Mm-hmm. They're walking billboards.
On the internet, no matter what page you go to nowadays,
right.
There's always ads.
Right, and with the blessing of flash, right, so that even when you're trying to look here, mm-hmm. it's going on over here.
Mm-hmm.
Look over here.
Any form of human communication.
Some of it more pervasive and pulling and infringes on your privacy. Right? Infringes, I think we call it spam, right? It infringes on your privacy. You can't get it out of your life.
But in that way, I mean, hasn't media always been there throughout history? I mean,
well, think about it. When I was young,
they used to call it gossip. Now it's just
okay, but when I was young, there was no such thing as a laptop.
It's not at all pervasive.
There was no such thing as a phone that you could carry around in your back pocket. If I wasn't home or I wasn't at the office, then no one could get in touch with me. I was pleasantly out of contact, right? And now people feel literally that I was reading an article about what they call now BlackBerry disease. Where it's actually breaking up marriages, BlackBerry disease, that people are so obsessed with being able to be connected all the time that they're connected more with people on the other side of the world than they are connected with people who are living in their own house. Right? Everybody walks in, goes to their own room, turns on their own thing. They never talk to each other. I did a statistical study of... there have been studies done, and I glean the information that they say now that the average child in America spends 38 minutes a week in meaningful conversation with their parents. 38 minutes. And the rest of the time, they're hooked up to somebody else. They're hooked, they spend 2.5 hours a day on television. And then there's computers and there's so many things.
Can you talk a little bit about the effects of social pressure? Because it seems like when you're talking about when we were young, there were only 7 TV stations.
Right.
It's like, thinking, how could you live with 7 TV stations? You have to kill yourself. There's not enough stimulation. But then, as you're saying, you know, the media is molding us, and they're molding our friends, and then it becomes a social pressure.
Well, like that Facebook story I told you, this so strong social pressure, right? That you actually feel self-conscious. If I want to dress in a certain way and everybody else is dressed differently, I feel extremely uncomfortable. Right? I feel very uncomfortable. There's a lot of conformity issues. But before I answer your question, Pradyumna had a question before, or a statement, and I never heard it.
I just wanted to say, yesterday we were just kind of touching on the topic of quality versus quantity. And you've been in the education field, so I wonder if to some degree, our kind of educational mindset that, exposure or overexposure is good, but it's almost like, exposure to multiple, whatever it is, is good. And now, I'm not going to go too much detail into that, but, I kind of experienced in my life the experience of overexposure or, having come from a certain culture and then experiencing a lot of things and identity crisis and this and that. So it's just very interesting to me, because I've experienced the danger zone of losing myself in too many things, I don't know. I just when I look into society today, I realize that people don't see a danger in that.
Well, they don't notice the danger until it's too late.
Yeah.
They don't know. One thing is that there is hyper exposure.
Yeah.
And what happens is that people think they've experienced life, but it's only been vicarious. So people think they know what it's like in India, even though they've never been there. They can Google it, and then they think that they've been there. Now, if you've ever been there, or you've ever been there, you know they don't know. And if they ever got off a plane in Delhi, within 10 minutes they would be totally confused. They wouldn't know what to do, right? But they think they know. They think they know what it's like to live the life of the person in another country or in another color or in another religion because they think they can experience it. They experience it in movies. They experience it in media of all kinds, and they really think that they know it. So what happens is, because of this overexposure to media, is that by the time someone's 20, they've already think they've done everything. Their life is like, okay, what's next? And we find many, many young people are really depressed and even consider ending their lives because they've looked at everything, they've seen everything, they've done everything. They're 20 years old, and what else is there to do? Nothing.
And also, as far as the value system goes, the people share, I wonder if this is the point you're making with the slides, the people shaping our value system, aren't necessarily the ones who have our best interests.
Well, that's what I was saying at the very beginning. What is the one, there's one purpose why people are shaping your value system? And that one purpose is to turn you into a consumer or to get your money somehow or other, to get your allegiance. They want you, your allegiance, and they want to keep it. They start thinking about what you're going to buy when you're 17, when you're 3, right? As soon as you're able, even before you're 3. And they start sending you images, they start sending you information, so that by the time you get to be a consumer, which is, probably by the time you're 13 or 14 when you're kind of on your own, now you have your own credit card, you can do your own thing, then they start sending you messages what you want to do with that freedom when you're 3. They got to set you up so by the time you're 13, you're already in their camp. They've already got you. You're already connected. And as they change the things that you need, you'll change with them. Right? If tomorrow, I remember my daughter, and this was years ago, my
middle daughter. She's 38 now. And I remember when she was young, she was looking pictures of me when I was a child. She said, "Mom, I'll never wear bell bottoms. I don't understand how you could possibly wear them. They're the funkiest looking things I've ever seen in my life." Now she's a fashion designer. She lives in San Francisco. And she's, you know, she's gone through periods where she was designing bell bottoms. So, because they go back, everything goes in cycles, and they sell you these things because you're connected to that grid. And actually, in academic circles, because my field is education, they say that although children now think that information is available to them, it's very easy for them to write a paper. They don't even need to go to a library. They don't need to look at a book. All they need to do is Google, hit take the top 10 hits, and they can even cut and paste it, right? They don't have to know anything. Hopefully that's not your doctor later on in life who did that, and that's how he learned surgery. But the fact is that there's no real information gathering. There's no discrimination. There's no looking to see what is a valid source, what isn't a valid source. Wikipedia, anyone can write on Wikipedia. You could be reading stuff that has no basis in reality whatsoever, but everybody agrees to accept it. There's no filters. The internet is a community, a very powerful community, but that internet has no police force. It has no monitoring, very little. If you see something horrible and you report it, they may take it down. But other than that, it's fair game for everybody. Yes. Well, she had a question first. Yes. I'm sorry, but I don't know anybody's name.
Hi, Lisa.
Lisa, hi.
I was just thinking that in Victorian novels, there's a similar thing where it taught you how to grieve. Mm-hmm. Is it better to flail about or better to be modest?
Mm-hmm.
And then how many carriages should you have? Mm-hmm. And how many houses should you visit as a lady to be a proper person?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not seeing a huge difference between that and then the media. I think it's more ubiquitous and invasive, but I think at a certain point everybody has agency to educate themselves and to make choices, you know?
That's definitely true, and that's why we're here, because we've decided to make certain choices. We've decided to swim upstream, so to speak. But the difference between reading a novel, which I have to get, which I have to take home, which I have to sit down with, which I have to read, and also, if you ever noticed, perhaps, I'm sure you have if you're a writer, that you read a book, let's say I read Lord of the Flies,
mm-hmm.
Okay? So when I read Lord of the Flies, I have a vision in my mind what each of those characters look like and what's going on, what the island looks like, what's going on there. But once I watch the movie, then I've digested somebody else's vision of what everyone looks like and what went on there. I had this experience with the Mahabharata series.
Mm-hmm.
In India, there's a very, very famous series of it's a very famous book called the Mahabharata. Bhagavad Gita is part of that book. So they made a 26-volume rendition of the Mahabharata with very famous actors, and it was quite well done. Many people watched the Mahabharata. They actually shut down factories and shops so that people could watch it. When it would go on, India would come to a grinding halt so that people could go wherever there was a TV or wherever there was a screen. 300 million people watching this movie, right? Okay, so then my students and I, we were traveling in India, and we went to Bombay, and we were in Mumbai, and we went into the ISKCON temple, and there was Krishna, the guy who played Krishna in that movie. But he was wearing blue jeans, and he's smoking a cigarette. And it was traumatizing, you know? It was, like, totally traumatizing. My girls were traumatized. And then you see pictures now, posters and drawings of the characters from the Mahabharata, and they look like the actors in that movie. That movie has destroyed the imaging of each individual and created a universal image. So that's one difference between the book and the imaging power of media, which, by the way, is constantly looking for new ways to get faster, to give you more images per minute than before, and also to like now, they have on a television, I only watch television maybe once a year when I go to my daughter's house, but they have this thing now where you can see what's on the station before and what's on the station after. right? So, and then you have the thing in the front of you, what you're watching. So if it comes to a commercial, then immediately you hit the thing and you go to the next place. And maybe you go back, maybe you don't. So the amount of information, the amount of presence, the amount of demand on your senses is multiplied by a billion times over reading that one little novel. Although certainly our morals and our standards and our opinions are given to us by stories. Ordinarily, when I do media awareness, that's where we start with how do we learn who we are? How do we learn what's right and what's wrong? And we learn by stories. Very often our grandparents tell us those stories, even today. But our grandparents have a different motive than the people who are trying to buy our consciousness and turn us into consumers.
Another nice story. I was in this country called Dominica, which basically hasn't changed for hundreds of years.
Until
it's
we
very
get
interesting. Anybody ever been in the Caribbean? It's unlike other Caribbean islands. It was never developed. So you go there, and it looks like it was, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. And so I met a lady there, and I said, she was a teacher, and I said, so it seems like the young people are very nice here. They seem very polite. And she said, they were, but now that we have satellite TV, everything's changed within a few years. And they say about India, India is a country which has been ruled by foreign invaders. And when foreign invaders rule countries, what they try to do is change the culture. The culture means the language, the dress, the food. And they could never do that in India. It was ruled by Muslims, and they couldn't even they would kill people, but still they couldn't change the culture. Then it was ruled by the British. And the British couldn't change. Change the language, change the food, change the religion, change the dress. But they still really couldn't do it. Really did a little bit. Now India is the largest speaking English country in the world. And they say that Indian accent is going to become the standard because there'll be more people speaking English in India. For you, I wouldn't speak like this. So.
But media has done what?
And they say something like, what couldn't be done by foreign invasion for thousands of years, Bollywood and MTV did in 10.
And not only that, but if I'm a foreigner, even if I'm at your house, you're in your apartment, I knock on your door, you open the little hole or whatever, and you look outside, you don't know who I am. Okay, so you don't just throw the door open and say, come on in, sit in my living room, stay here all day, sleep here if you want. But TV or computer, it's in your house, and anyone comes in. And you give them a seat of honor. In most houses you walk in, the computer or the TV will be in the center of the main room of the house. And everyone's connected to it for a significant amount of their time. So you're letting strangers into your life, into your ears, into your eyes, into all the portals of your body. You're letting them tell you how to live your life. You're letting them tell you what's right, what's wrong. And the interesting thing is you walk away from that experience thinking that that's your opinion. Right? That's your opinion. Now if someone challenges that, you'll argue with them. You'll say, no, I'm not dressed this way because I want to look good in someone else's eyes. I'm dressed this way because it makes me feel good about myself. And that's why I dye my hair. And that's why I wear these clothes and not those clothes. And that's why I speak the way I speak. It's not because the TV told me. It's because I feel that that's right. And it's not true. You've been sold a philosophy or a way of life, and you've imbibed it so deeply that now you think it's yours. They say diplomacy is that when you can make somebody else think what your opinion is theirs. Yes.
What's interesting about that, it reminds me of there's this professor at the University of Florida who does research for retailers, and his job is to track the trend of a consumer by zip code. And the retailers come into this area based on your consumer trend.
Exactly.
So they come in and they set up shop. They put the products that they put on the aisles, or how they set up the store, what they have on inventory, how it looks from the outside, what ads goes into that zip code is based on what you already buy and what you already like. So you go into a store and you're like, Target has everything I want, but what you don't realize is the retailer already knew what you were wanting before you even got to the store, before they even came into town.
And the advertiser was selling you what you wanted
right.
before you even got your zip code. So it's a whole network.
Well, I think, you know, culturally, I think what's very interesting, you know, like, for example, the Bhagavad Gita, you know, it presents the four classes of men and four types of work. And so I was having this whole conversation with a friend of mine, and like the Vaishyas, which are the businessmen, you know, like one of the things that Krishna says is that in every action there's fault. And so, you know, we don't have this kind of moral superiority because you're a Vaishya or a Kshatriya or whatnot, that you realize that every action has some fault in it. Whereas if you look at the kind of like a Western paradigm, I mean, you know, being a businessman has a certain degree of respectability in itself. Like, you don't need to do anything to purify yourself or purify your work. And, you know, finally, I mean, society's getting like to the point where, you know, we talk about socially responsible business. You know, there's this notion
talk
that,
about
well, yeah. I mean, there's this notion of that just pursuing money for its sake is not enough, mm-hmm. and that you know, there's this what carbon footprint, and you know, there's all these concepts coming on, and you know, I was kind of writing that down. It's like, you know, because otherwise the pervasive mood was positivism and abundance mentality, and there's enough for everybody, and you just need to keep going out and earning money, and there's enough for everybody, and there's enough to go around. And you know, what we're finding with, you know, Al Gore's what inconvenient truth, and the global warming thing is no. Well, it turns out that we can't just you know, go on and on consuming as much as we want without there being consequences. And so, what I see is it's almost like a clash of philosophies happening in society.
But the interesting thing is that what's happened now is green is the biggest growth industry that there is. So what they've done is they've taken this problem and they've marketed it.
Yeah.
And now they're selling it back to you. So everything's green.
And you find out now they've come out, there's a guy called Infowars.com, and he talks about how they've found out that all the 12,000 scientists that Al Gore says they used, they were all in on the story. Like, mm-hmm. they used all the scientists that was just on their side. They didn't really take a random amount of scientists mm-hmm. and use their data. So it's like,
what it is ultimately is that whatever we learn, the media people, there's, first of all, you should, I mean, I don't know where you want me to stop, because this is like the
yeah.
tip of an iceberg.
Stop it. Finish this and we'll stop because we should take a break.
Okay. All of media, all of it, all the Blockbuster video stores, all the book publishers, all the MVT movies, all the movies that you see, you know, in the movie theaters, if they still have movie theaters, I don't know. You know, all the stuff that you're downloading on your computer, all the music that you're listening to in your iPod, all these things are controlled by guess how many companies? Close, very close. Five or six. Some, it's hard to tell whether they're independent or not. But there are six major international companies, five of them are from America, one of them is from Germany, that control all the media in the whole world. All the media. Everything. They have...
They're also connected with a zillion other companies.
Right. They're all connected with a lot of other things, but they own, you know, they own... the Sara Lee and Bayer Aspirin and VIP luggage, and you know, it goes down, 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 down. Practically, these six companies control almost everything you do and think. So if you really want to take back your individuality, you know, your decision-making power and your ability to look inside and concentrate yourself on your practice, it takes some determination. You're really fighting a formidable foe. You know, you're fighting. There's a significant Goliath out there, and you're just David. So, you know, get your slingshot ready, and you have to take shelter really of the spiritual world, because the spiritual world is described in Bhagavad Gita, Daivihi Esha Gunamayi Mama Maya Durachaya, that this material energy is very difficult to control, to overcome. You can't do it by yourself. It's so much bigger than you. Therefore, you need to connect with this spiritual divinity, this spiritual energy, and that's where you get your strength, your power.
So we're going to take a break?
Yes, we're going to take a break.
So you can all use the bathroom, get water, get air, whatever you require. And we'll meet back in about 10 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. It's too fancy. Sorry. It's 20 minutes. It's like not possible.
It's 15. Everyone was engaged. Yeah. It's an endless.
And see, now I know where I'm going. So if I had to, I could prepare something very sequentially because I was all over the place. But I think you're connected to
all the philosophy, how we're controlled. This is a general point. It's not even without the media, we're controlled by the media and how more insidious it is.
Most have the agent.
The aspect of playing into the, we're already so easily to be played into because we have so many desires.
Manu made a very nice point. He said that, because I used to teach to my younger students, and he said it's so helpful when you become angry at the media. Instead of getting mad at your mother for not letting you walk around in clothes that you really shouldn't wear, you get mad at the people who sell misconceptions of yourself that you really don't buy.
The last
so
10 years
by this time
on and off traveling
in progress, it helps people to kind of decide
what
they want to do.
So we're
so much more conscious.
I'm Boulder.
I think a lot of it is the culture we grew up in. Modern culture was so
part of our own.
Still, when we become devotees,
that
generation is a little easier. You'll have to be in a little bit
of
a outer culture.
So I would go on Sundays, but usually sitting in the very back.
You don't see, you don't distinguish yourself.
Yeah, and plus at that time,
I'm also and there's media about, quite a few people.
I was living in the house,
and my husband goes, "Oh, listen to what where this is." And I'm like, "That's where I was."
That's much more scary, even though it's just stuff. It helped me detach from seeing my mom and my sister.
Most men don't really feel comfortable with people having disabilities in Hawaii, and this whole idea of coming in touch with yourself, sharing it especially, and admitting weaknesses openly, and it's just like Yeah, I think we should tell that on the mountain.